This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest New York City poet, Puma Pearl. How are you, Puma?
I'm good, Rich.
Good. Excellent. Thanks for being on the show today.
Pleasure to be here. How are you?
I'm doing well. Puma Pearl is a widely published poet and writer. She is the author of two chapbooks and one full-length poetry collection, Knuckle Tattoos. She was the co-creator, co-producer, and main curator of D-Day Productions. Her newest venture is Puma Pearl's Pandemonium, which launched at the Bowery Electric in 2012 and brings poetry together with rock and roll. As Puma Pearl and Friends, she performs regularly with a group of excellent musicians. A new poetry collection, Retrograde, will be published this year by Great Weather for Media Press, followed by a collection of short stories on Punk Hostage Press, which means, Puma, you and I will be literary stablemates. That's very cool.
That's right. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Is yours out or yours is in the works?
No. It's out already.
Oh, then I need to get one.
So how did you hook up with Punk Hostage, with Iris and Razor?
Razor and I had connected online, and I don't quite some time ago. I'm not exactly sure how far back we go, and Razor also has a history on the Lower East Side. So as I got to know Razor, I found that we connected in many ways.
Nice.
In the past. But at some point, he had suggested our mutual friend, Jimmy, who was moving down from Boston, find me.
Okay, good.
That's James Tropiano, who will also be published on Punk Hostage Press when he finishes a novel that he's working on. So he came down here. He contacted me on Razor's suggestion, and from the jump, he was telling me, "You got to meet Iris. You got to meet Iris Berry," because he had developed a telephone relationship with her. She's your like West Coast sister. You got to meet her. And we were like Facebook friends, but not really connected. And then what happened was 2 years ago, I was going out to the poetry festival in the Bay that included the Beast Crawl in Oakland.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think you were there.
No, I wasn't able to make that trip. I had some shows here in L.A.
Right. So at that point, Iris and I started talking on the phone before I was going to go out there. And there was a barbecue at Razor's, and it was one of those things that were like, insisted, you're coming. I don't know. We'll come get you. You're coming. And another internet friend, poet Jason Harding, who I had been friends with online for many years, going back to MySpace, was also there. So he picked me up, and we went, and it was one of those things where I walked in and I said, oh, my God, I am home. I am so home with these people, you know?
Nice.
Yeah, it's like a great photo of Iris and I. Like 2 seconds after we met, we're sitting on the stairs, my blonde West Coast sister, her dark East Coast sister, you know what I mean? just great connection, and I felt like an eraser for years, and there were other people who were coming in that I actually did know, so it was just a great time, and we've been close ever since.
Great. Hey, before I start throwing a bunch of questions your way, why don't we start with you doing a poem? How's that?
Sure. I'm going to do the first poem that will open the new collection, which is called Retrograde. And it's called Gravity. The night the birds fell, I dreamt of two women. They perched on platforms above the clouds, bodies coiled like snakes, wild hair, long necks, one blonde, one dark. Unwinding their bodies, they stepped out, arms raised, tumbling gracefully downwards, free falls to planet Earth. A globe forever in rotation, where time is measured in darkness and rain and the short, hard lives of caterpillars. The next morning, I step over broken wings, feathers, and high-heeled shoes. Birds and beautiful women have fallen from the sky, magnetized by planetary forces. Balls have stopped bouncing. Clocks do not wind. High tide drifts out to sea, oak trees sway, waiting patiently. Birds and women have fallen. the earth has lost its force. Only the stars still matter. End.
Nice. That was beautiful. And I love how you start the poem, "The Night the Birds Fell," and you keep coming back to that image. You know, it reminds me of this Sam Shepard poem from Motel Chronicles where he talks about a dead bird he found in a parking lot, and like in the middle of nowhere near water, and was, you know, he just was sort of, he wondered about the fact, you know, how a bird could be so confused to mistake a parking lot in the middle of nowhere for water. I don't know. Anyway, it's a beautiful poem. You know, actually, you mentioned that it's going to be the first poem in your new collection, Retrograde. Why don't we talk about that for a moment? You know, which is going to be released by Great Weather for Media. From what I understand, Jane Ormerod says, who is one of the people in charge of Great Weather for Media, love Jane Ormerod, she was actually on the show before, she says that you're the first standalone author for Great Weather for Media. Is that correct?
That's correct. They've been putting out a yearly anthology. I think this year is the third one. And she's had other ventures before, but they were all anthology-based.
Well
done. They
had
not published a standalone poet. That's true.
Yeah, what an honor. I mean, you must feel pretty good about that.
Oh, yeah. It's a total honor, and they're great. And I was actually there when Jane was doing her radio show with you. That's when we were on tour with Great Media. And she was kind of, we had gone to perform in this place in Santa Fe, and she was kind of like, okay, I'm just going to go find, like, somewhere to sit and talk to Rich for an hour, you know?
Nice. You know, I read an article about you in New York's Villager, and it started out like this. Puma Pearl is a survivor. Even she isn't quite sure how she managed to escape with everyone around her ODing, dying from AIDS, or just disappearing. There's no one from the old days left to hang out with. I'm curious, what were those days like for you? You know, how do you feel you managed to survive those times, and how would you say those experiences figure into your work?
Well, I think The experiences definitely figure into the work, because they were, I was writing out the demons, you know, because even if you survive, and as far as how I survived, probably because I had two kids.
Right.
Probably that's what saved my life, that I could not completely let go of any hope of getting clean, that there was always that little mustard seed of hope, even when I didn't know it was there. And it was pretty shaky. Now, how I survived that I didn't get infected with HIV like almost everyone else during those times, that I have no answer for. You know, I mean, how did I survive ODs? Because somebody was around and dragged me out of an abandoned building and threw me in a fire hydrant. You know, that's how that happened, you know, and other things like that, like very literally. But in the big picture, like, why me? You know, no reason. Why me? Why not me? So I guess that was kind of part of what I was writing about. And then, like, years go by, and you look back, and you say, damn, like, I missed so much of my life, like everything that I love now, I was not doing then, because it was all centered around the obsession to use.
Yeah.
You know? So you try to live as much as possible. Well, I don't know what other people try to do. I try to live as much as possible now. You know, like, you can't really make up for lost time, but you can at least decide that you're going to do everything you can, and it's kind of frustrating not to be able to do everything, you know?
Yeah. Do you look back on those times at all and beat yourself up for one thing or another, or have you kind of looked back on the you that was then and sort of come to some sort of sense of peace with that, or what do you feel like when you look back on the you in those times?
Well, you know, there's an expression of look back, don't stare.
Yeah.
So, if you get too caught up in it, I mean, you could. I'm clean 26 years, going on 27.
Well done.
You know, so that's a pretty long time. So to continue, you know, and there's a reason why you do a lot of things. Like I'm not a huge meeting goer anymore, but I was involved in 12-step recovery, and there's a reason why you make amends, even though you can't change the past. That's the way you find peace. You know, that's one of the ways you find peace. There are a lot of things you could do to find some peace in life. And I'm not doing all of them. I could be a lot stronger on the belief and the meditation and the spirituality than I am. You know,
right.
But I could let it all go. I could say, okay, I fucked up. That was my life. The only thing that probably the rest of my life that I will never have 100% peace with is that I dragged two kids through this.
Yeah.
You know, that I could still, if I allow it, you know, if I encourage it, if I throw a party in my head for a bunch of, like, you know, people to torture me at, you know what I'm saying? If I turn my mind into a death chamber,
right,
then I could certainly beat myself up tremendously to the point where I could become immobile behind that.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't go back and change that. You can't, like, you know, influence, you know, like feel like you robbed a piece of a childhood that, you know, of the souls you were given to protect, and say, well, I can't. I can say, well, it's not, it's okay. But you know what? I have relationships with my kids. They're great people. I have great relationships with their kids. They forgive me 100 times more than I could ever forgive myself.
Yeah. You know, one of your most recent collections of poems, Knuckle Tattoos, would you say that collection chronicles a lot of these experiences, your journey through these times from, let's say, self-destruction to recovery?
Oh, absolutely. That is the one that did chronicle that. And I could compare it. They say that when a person writes their first novel, it's more or less always autobiographical.
Right. Right.
And I think that's what that was.
Yeah.
You know, so for better or worse, that's what that was. And I still use some of those poems. And in fact, that poem, that collection ends on with a note of hope. You know, it ends with a very short poem called 20 Years in a Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that piece integrating with other pieces. Like recently, we did this Johnny Cash night. So we took his cover of Hurt, you know, the Nine Inch Nails song, and I did a chorus like that was really pulled from pieces of all of those poems in between. So my friend Rick that I sometimes work with singing a chorus of the song, and at the end, I end with a refrain, which is the last line of it. As long as I keep looking up, everything stays clean.
Nice. Do you by any chance have that collection handy? You could read that poem, 20 Years in a Day?
Yeah, I can, actually.
Great.
20 Years in a Day. Sundays were vicious. Liquor stores were closed. Mornings melted into noon heat. My shirt collar was a blade carving letters into my neck. Today is Sunday. 20 Years in a Day. Coltrane thanks the universe. His supreme love calls upon the sun. Sunday, a walking meditation. Coffee is hot and nobody hurts. I'm a 3 o'clock kid without training wheels. I fly through dark streets searching for Spalding's on rooftops. As long as I keep looking up, everything stays clean.
That's great. You know, I feel so much of New York and just that sort of attitude and, through your work. And I remember that when I first saw you read, actually, out here in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
at Stories.
What's it been? Stories, yeah.
In Echo Park. I think that was one of the first things that attracted me to you and your work because, you know, I'm from the East Coast, New Jersey, and I've spent a lot of time in New York, and it was really nice to get that flavor out here on the West Coast. It kind of made me a bit homesick. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I actually didn't know you were from New Jersey.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you're, speaking of knuckle tattoos, that's considered, I was sort of doing a little bit of research, and that's considered to be your, in quotes, I book, capital letter I, in comparison to your previous chapbook, Belinda and Her Friends. I was hoping you could talk about that distinction between the two and what made you change from take the leap from one form to the other.
Well, yeah, Belinda and Her Friends was the first chapbook that I had published. And then, as you said, there was Knuckle Tattoos. And after that, I had another chapbook that went back to having a character called Ruby Trill. So with Belinda and Her Friends, I am talking about those times, but in a much more narrative storytelling way, and I'm telling the story of an actual person. I mean, everything in Belinda and Her Friends is based on reality, but I am the narrator. I'm not a character in it,
right.
And it's not my voice until the very last piece, which was called Where We Sat. That was the first title. It was called On Broken Benches. And it was about life going on in Tompkins Square Park after the death of Belinda and of so many other people in that book. In fact, I think everybody in that book is gone.
Wow.
So it was a narrative. And then what happened was that chapbook won the Urbacci Prize for the best chapbook of the year, and the awards was publishing a full-length collection.
Oh, nice.
Which is, yeah, that's how Knuckle Tattoos came to be, you know. So now I had this opportunity to publish a full-length collection, and I remember trying to pull it together and like writing manuscripts and like, it's really hard to write your first full-length collection. I mean, it's probably hard to write it every time, but that was really challenging, you know. And then somehow it became this sort of, you know, the theme, because I think we always have a theme, whether it's obvious to the reader or not, but we have to have it to pull a collection together.
Sure.
So as I was trying to figure out what to write, because I could not find a theme, I started writing a poem for every day of the week. And I realized that was the theme.
Oh, nice!
That it was this narrative of my life, but not necessarily in any kind of linear way, but it all tied to whatever the day of the week poem it was. So the book does go from poems about childhood to that end, of ending on some hope.
Right, with the Sunday piece.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, with the Sunday piece. With some journeys in between. It covers a road trip. It is autobiographical. And I think everything I write has the truth in it from my life, because the dedication to this book is going to be something like, any resemblance to real characters living or dead is truly intentional.
Nice. You know, with Belinda speaking in that narrative voice, do you feel that perhaps gave you certain liberties to speak about certain matters in a way that you might not be able to do if you were speaking from that I voice?
Maybe at that time, you know, but I think I've spoken with that I voice pretty like in a pretty raw and naked way since then, but you know, those poems were written in maybe 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like really a while ago, and that was really after I had, that was right about the time I started writing seriously, because I was not writing poetry for many years at
right.
all. So that was when I was just really, really first writing again. You know, so it's hard to say exactly. So if what you're saying may be true, but it was probably on a very subconscious level.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw this mentioned too when I was, you know, reading about you and things, that right around 2007, like you just said, you started getting, you know, serious into the writing. And, you know, in the career, let's say, of being a writer, that isn't that long ago. And I'm curious, either, you know, taking a break from writing or whatever was going on in that sort of, let's call it a gestation period, for lack of a better word, do you feel that maybe your somewhat newness to the form has given you certain insights, let's say, into writing? Because, you know, once you started writing seriously in 2007, a lot of great things have happened for you. You won the award, you know, Great mm-hmm. Weather is publishing you as a standalone poet, you know, and if you look back, it's like, well, you know, she started writing seriously in 2007, which is only like 7 years ago. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, on the one hand, it's kind of like spirituality and religion. Like if you come into spiritual practices having had no religious upbringing at all, your slate's a lot cleaner in yeah. terms of your preconceived notions.
Yep.
And you kind of just do it. On the other hand, it's not that I wasn't writing, it's that I wasn't writing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of what I was writing, I had gone to school at like a rather late age. I did done everything at a late age. So you could say if I was like kind of reborn 26 years ago.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like they say like when you get clean, you're kind of at the mental age where you started using. You know, so in terms of that, everything's happening except my age on paper doesn't correlate to my life.
Yes.
If you get what I mean.
Yes.
But you know, I had done a lot of writing. I had put myself through college. I put myself through graduate school. I had done these creative projects in graduate school, and in my undergraduate work, even though I got a master's in social work, what I studied in my undergraduate work was a lot of non-traditional theater, and I was writing plays and doing my master's. Like I was able to, because I got attracted to the idea of like merging social work with the arts, except for that particular area, my timing wasn't very good because there's really not much available if you're not doing something very, very concrete, fundable services these days,
right.
Unless you could start something of your own. So I was never really able to do what I wanted, but I was able to do those projects, which really opened up a lot of doors for me in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of what I wanted to do and where I felt alive, and you know, and so even though I couldn't get to writing as much as I wanted for a while, it, like you said, there probably was a gestation period. I just wasn't really like, you know, never thought of it in those terms, but yeah, probably so.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned social work, and in addition to your performances, you also helped to produce shows and perform community service work. In fact, I believe you've facilitated writing workshops and have even worked with Rikers Island, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
I did.
So why don't you talk a little about some of that, your community service work and what you've done with Rikers?
Well, I haven't really done any community service work for a while, but at Rikers I got an opportunity with a friend of mine named Rita Hickey, volunteered and still does for the Fortune Society, and I had always felt it important to go into the prisons. And so when I was working as a social worker and when I was working, even before I started that, when I was like an outreach worker and a volunteer, I've always gone into the prisons I used to do series of education about HIV and AIDS and a lot of different things. I never wanted to work full time in the prisons because that's rough,
yeah.
You know, but I always, you know, It's weird even to link the word enjoy with prisons because there's so much, and jails, like Rikers Island is in a prison, it's a jail, but just, you know, the whole routine of going into it, all of the different checkpoints, you know, and you know when you're inside, and this has happened to me, not there, but at Arctic Hill, if they do a count after lunch and there's a fork missing, you know, like you're not getting out for like 6 hours
until they find
a fork. So it's rough. So we did this workshop as volunteers. We did it over a summer. We did it in the day room. We couldn't, there was no and it was in the Fortune Society cell block, and these guys, you know, they didn't have to go to the workshop. They went because they wanted to go, and for the most part, they were real cooperative, because all these guys were going to get released to, you know, Fortune Society, to the Fortune Society for their kind of aftercare, and they didn't want to fuck it up at this point, you know.
Yeah.
You weren't with a bunch of guys who were probably going away from there. Although some of them, they were awaiting sentencing. Some of them could have been, but you know, they weren't into like causing any problems, you know. So that was all fine. But you know, so you get to Rikers Island and you go through all these searches and you go through everything and you finally get in there, and then you're in a day room where there's no air conditioning. You can't have the fan on because that's a potential weapon. That's the only place everyone has to dry their dirty socks and stuff. And you're doing a poetry workshop with these guys and they're into it.
Wow.
There's some who are so fucking thorazine down or whatever they're using, they're not so into it, but a lot of them are really into it. And we're not getting paid for this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So at the end, and it was like a trial run. It was like, let's see if you could do this. Let's see if this works. So we did this whole trial run. And then at the end, you know, they said, well, you know, this is great, and we loved having you here. This was so successful, and, you know, you made our jobs easier. And, you know, we're talking to people who make six figures telling us how we make their life easier by working for free. Okay, so do you want to pay us to do this? And that was like, well, no, you know,
right.
We'll get volunteers to do this.
Yeah.
So, and my friend, God bless her, she's doing it to this day. She believes in the work. She was willing to continue. I give her all the credit in the world for that. But for me, you know, I think we should get paid for our work.
Yeah. When you were working with some of these guys, would you see any sort of visible change in them from when you first went in, let's say, to when they started expressing themselves through words?
You don't really know them well enough to be
yeah.
able to see any visible change, because somebody can actually, you know, somebody can have that visible insight for a moment.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean like there's going to be a change. And there's some guy, and I remember a couple of guys said, where can I go when I get out? I want to go to the New Eureka Poets Cafe. I want to do this. I want to do that. So at least by making something accessible to somebody who maybe didn't know that was accessible to them, by that you're doing a great service. Because for me, I always track my roots back to the New Eureka Poets Cafe. Because when that opened on 6th Street, it opened, you know, in the community. It wasn't the East Village that it is now. It was the Lower East Side. It was the mid-70s. And people who, you know, like myself, who never thought that something like being a poet was something they would have any access to. People from the street, people who couldn't read, everybody was going to the cafe and doing poetry, and it was, like, amazing.
Yeah.
So that's really where my roots came from. So if we even, through our time in Rikers Island or any of the other places I've gone, if you showed one person that the world of art is open to them too, and of course it's, now you see faces of color and all kinds, you know, you didn't connect poetry in that way as much.
Right.
We're going back like 35 years, almost 40 years ago now, you know?
Yeah.
But from when Miguel Algarin and me and Pedro Pietri and all these guys started putting that poetry out, that was transformational.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Bob Holman, who was actually my first guest on Poet Escape, I believe he helped to get that whole scene started.
Well, he actually didn't help to get that started. He connected with Algarin in, was it 2002?
Okay.
He helped get a lot of scenes started, but I wouldn't say he helped get that scene started. He connected with Algarin, and he was kind of the co-facilitator, co-director at the New Eureka Poets Cafe, and everything was cool for a couple of years, and they had some huge falling out, and he opened the Barrie Poetry Club,
okay.
Which was fantastic. And which really, like, one thing about the Barrie Poetry Club was it was just something for everybody. I mean, there was poetry for the deaf. There was poetry for kids. You know, there was poetry if you just came from Romania. There was, like, a show, you know, based on every level where the, you know, the cafe, as great as it is a little bit more ethnocentric.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
hasn't the Barrie Poetry Club recently gone through some drastic changes?
Yeah, it has. I did shows there for a few years,
right.
Actually, when I had DJ Productions, and I was on the I forgot what we called it. We used to meet at Bob's house every month, like people who were involved in doing producing shows to try to, you know, figure out how to keep it going. And the bottom line was it always was operating from the red. They were never able to make the independent ventures that they tried in the front that was supposed to be, you know, entrepreneurial. It just never worked out well. So the decision was made, not by my committee, the decision was made by Bob and the board of directors and the Barry in Arts and Sciences, you know, because there's like, anyway, I don't even want to get into all that, but they wound up merging with Duane Park, which is a supper club on Duane Street and sort of a burlesque cast.
Right.
So Duane Park did all of the renovations, reopened in a much more upscale way, and eventually the Barry Poetry Club did get two nights because it's Sunday night and Monday night when Duane Park is dark anyway. But it's very different.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
it's really different.
Yeah. Well, how about New York in general? Because you've lived there your whole life. What are some changes you've seen New York go through, or the overall poetry scene go through in your time there?
Well, you know, we could go off like forever on how everything was lost.
Yeah.
You know, like I was doing shows at the Barry Poetry Club, which is not an accessible place to me anymore, and at the Yippie Cafe, Yippie Museum Cafe, which also closed. You know, so you can look online almost every day and see something that a landmark is closing, whether it's Bleecker Bob's or Junior's. You know, it just keeps becoming less like the New York we knew. But then, on the other hand, it's a city where you can still go out every night.
Yeah.
You know, if you have the energy, you can go out every night. And if you want to eat dinner at 4 in the morning, there's some place you can eat. Like when I go on the road and everything, you know, closes like at 10 o'clock somewhere, I'm like, what the fuck, you know? You can still travel 24 hours. You can still get on a subway 5 in the morning or grab a cab. So in that sense, we still have New York. There still is a scene in New York, you know. It's not what it's not what it was, but the poetry scene, for me, you know, when the Barry Poetry Club closed and I knew the Yippie was going to close, and I was thinking, like, how do I keep presenting my work? Because I didn't just do poetry. I was doing a lot of performance art at that point.
Yeah.
With my co-creators of DJ Production, Big Mike and FOMO. So, you know, our shows were not they were never straight-up poetry. So I was just kind of thinking that because I love rock and roll and I love going to shows, and most people who love rock and roll don't realize what poetry is.
Yeah.
You know, like they think that they don't like it because of, you know, the way it's given to us in school. So I said, okay, and this is just in my head. I'm thinking I should bring poetry to rock and roll because they're not going to come to me for the most part, except a couple of my friends. I should bring it there. And I'm thinking this, and all of a sudden, all these musicians start contacting me.
Interesting.
And asking me, hey, you want to open a show for me, or you want to do, you know. And we had already done a couple little things together, like I'd include them in Make Music New York, but somehow it just became like, you know, like in The Stand, when you go to the good side or the dark side, it became like this common dream. It just sort of started to happen, you know.
Yeah.
And it just kind of kept happening.
Nice.
So, you know, So I got a new audience, a totally new audience that way. There's not a lot of poets that come to my shows other than the Great Weather for Media crew.
Interesting. Do you ever get people, let's say, you know, for lack of a better term, non-poetry people, so to say, do you ever get people that come up to you after one of your shows and say something like, you know, I never used to be that much into poetry, or I never really appreciated poetry until I saw the way you do it with music?
Mm-hmm. I get that like all the time. Even if I do it with music or don't do it with music, it's able, and I'm not saying that out of being like egotistical, but that's like the greatest gift that I get.
Yeah.
That people thought that this was something, they thought it was something they didn't like when they didn't realize it was something they hadn't even tried.
Right, Right.
So it was kind of, you know, it was kind of what the New Eurekan Poets Cafe did for us. It's kind of what we hope we did for someone at Rikers Island. Like, say, like this is here, you can open up a new window in your mind, you know.
Yep.
And people, you know, and I do, I get a lot more feedback doing it the way I do it than I did, you know, for doing it for other poets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's different, you know.
Yeah. Well, speaking of music and everything, you have a track called Best Day of the Year that I want to play in just a second. If I'm not mistaken, you recorded it with a group called the Ne'er-do-wells?
Yeah. Did you ever meet Brant Lyon?
No, I never met him in person. I corresponded with him a little bit and understood from Jane Ormerod that he was an appreciator of my work, and I've seen some of his videos. He seemed like a great guy.
Right, and Brant was one of the editors of Great Weather for Media and also involved in previous ventures, and he did so many things, and he was also very, very into music. He was also a very talented musician, and he had a series called Hydrogen Jukebox in which he, you know, would get a band, a house band, and there would be features and an open mic, and the band would play behind everybody unless they didn't want them to for some reason. But the
right.
band would play behind everyone, and somehow, I don't know how they did it, but they would just key into whatever you were doing. It didn't matter if they'd seen you before. They were amazing. So we all got to know them pretty well, and Brant decided to put this project together. The CD is called Brain Ampin', which is still available on Amazon and I guess other places. And he got a recording studio in Long Island City, and we all went to, you know, he asked, I guess, 10 of us who were regulars with Hydrogen Jukebox and the Ne'er-do-wells to go out and do this. And we recorded it in one day.
Nice, nice. Recorded the whole CD in one day, or your track
yep.
and went the whole
no,
CD?
No, we each took two takes. Like, that was it, you know? Yeah.
Nice. Well, then why don't we go ahead and listen to it? This is Puma Pearl with The Best Day of the Year.
We hung out on the roof at Cha-Cha's watching the mermaid parade. This is my favorite day of the year, said Sammy. Snapping pictures with a camera recently lifted from a Buick. They need mambo mermaids, I said, as zombie mermaids, vampire mermaids sauntered by. He ignored me, entranced by glittery pasties and hundreds of boobs. I had met Danny at the Siren Festival. You can be my Coney Island baby was the first thing he told me while the New York Dolls played. And we danced straight down Surf Avenue to Seagate, where he rented a room from a bunch of rabbis. Been together almost a year. You don't need calendars on the board. Well, time is measured by cyclone screens, sideshows, wooden horses. Shadows on the sand by memories of striped chairs and thunderbolt rides. We climbed down the stairs from Cha-Cha's. Danny tried to steal an antique car, but nobody took him seriously. Kids paraded in wigs left behind by drunken mermaids who now litter the streets, tasting blood. This is the best day of the year, said Danny, as we drank warm beer and headed towards the after party. We were never invited, but it was the best day of the year and we weren't worried about a thing.
That was Puma Pearl with the Ne'er-do-wells and the Best Day of the Year. You know, Puma, I think you already answered the question, but when I was first listening to the track, I was trying to figure out whether it was recorded live, you know, because there are all those voices, you know, audience sounds in there, or if those were sounds that were sort of put into the track after, you know, you had recorded it in a studio. But, you know, either way, it really lent a feel to New York and Coney Island. I also love that line, time is measured by cyclone screams. That was really cool. I love the cyclone, by the way.
Oh, yeah? I don't, but I went on it once in my life, and I said I never have to do this ever again, although I do have a tattoo of it.
Yeah, well, actually, I wanted to talk about that, because speaking of Coney Island, which obviously holds a special place in your heart, you're part of the Tattooed Poets Project, and you have a tattoo inspired by Coney Island, and I was hoping you could talk about it.
Actually, I think I have two on there. I have, and they're both with mermaids because, you know, as this poem shows, I love the Mermaid Parade. I've marched in it for a number of years, and before that, I would watch it all the time. So, I had this little refrigerator magnet, which with this cute little mermaid. So I kind of used her as the figure and had the Wonder Wheel drawn in the back. So I also have a Coney Island poem called Riding the Wonder Wheel.
Right.
And then later, you know, I got the artist is Emma Griffith, and I liked her work, and I said, well, maybe we'll put the mermaid. I had a vision in my head of mermaids riding the cyclone. You know, so
yeah.
I didn't get the exact vision I wanted because it was a little too big for my arm, but so we did another one of a mermaid on a cyclone. So that, and then I thought about just continuing on with Coney Island, but you know, I stopped
right.
There with
and
Coney Island.
Yeah, you know, because you blur the line between poetry and music, are there certain artists within this medium that you feel have been an inspiration to you?
Well, I am extremely lucky that I work with these amazing musicians, and they are so inspiring. And we've never rehearsed. We've never had a rehearsal. And I work with a lot of different people, but the three people I work with the most are Geoff Wilson on guitar, Danny Ray on sax, and Walter Stenning on violin. And we work telepathically. It's the only way I could put it.
Right.
Like someone once asked Danny Ray something about what key we were using, and he just said, "We speak in tongues." You know.
Nice.
Yeah. And I really feel so incredibly fortunate that I can work with musicians like that. So that's really, really inspiring. But in terms of other people that I'm inspired by, I would say Lou Reed.
Yeah.
Marianne Faithfull, because of the transition she has made with her voice, because I'm not a singer,
mm-hmm.
you know, and but then really neither was Lou Reed,
right.
And you know, neither is Marianne. So even though you can anymore, she was, but she's, you know, she's really doing more. It's more, it's closer to spoken word. Obviously, I'm inspired by Jim Carroll and Patti Smith, you know, of course. But, you know, I'm inspired by people who have learned how to use what they have in very, very different ways. So I'm finding, like, more and more I'm not singing, but it's using my voice in different ways.
Well, actually, that brings me to my next question. When you perform with musicians versus, let's say, when you perform solo, do you feel that your delivery changes in any way?
Oh yeah, yeah. There's a totally different rhythm, and there's something going on. There's just the chemistry going on stage that's not going to happen when you're by yourself.
Right.
You know, and well, sometimes there will be a call and response kind of thing. Occasionally, like I work different ways with different people. Like when I was doing the Johnny Cash thing with my friend Rick Eckley, we actually structured it and rehearsed it. You know, but that never happens with anyone else. You know?
Right.
Like, so we do our pieces in a certain way. But yeah, it's completely different performing with musicians and performing solo. And I like doing both, but performing solo is not giving me the energy and the high that performing with musicians is doing.
Right. So when you write, would you say that, let's say when you write for the page versus writing for the stage or whatever, is there any distinction between the two? Do you sometimes write pieces thinking like, yeah, this one will be a really good live performance piece versus, yeah, this one I think is more just for the page?
If I'm writing a poem because I have an idea to write a poem, at that point I'm not thinking about it in terms of what kind of performance piece it's going to be. I'm going to see its potential after it's written and after I do it solo. However, when I work with musicians, like I've worked twice with a band called the Mark McKay Band, and the way I worked with them was very different because it's very different going into someone else's band than having your own band.
Sure.
Like, one of the things that happens with the, and I don't exactly have a band, it's Puma Po and Franz, and those are the three people who are, you know, my best friends of everyone I work with, I would say. But when I work with them, they improvise behind me, and it's amazing the control that they use, because like Danny Ray, for example, is known as Danny Ray and his exploding sax, and when he's working with me, it's like he's not exploding the way he usually does, you know? And Geoff Wilson, he's an amazing singer-songwriter, but he considers himself, you know, background when he works with me. And Walter Stenning, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he used to open for the, he was managed by Lou Reed, he opened for the Velvet Underground, Blondie. His art career was managed by Andy Warhol. He's iconic, you know. So that he's on stage playing violin with me. It just fucking blows me away every time I play with them all, you know, that they're there for me like that.
Yeah.
But when I went to play with this other band, we did it a very, very different way. Like, Mark is a singer-songwriter, and he also plays with Eric Amble, Phil Cimino, and Keith Christopher. It's a four-piece band. And he did one of his songs, and I came in with one of my poems, and then he finished his song, and then I did some improv, but I also incorporated some of his lyrics into what I was doing.
Yeah.
So now, you know, I'm thinking about, and I've done, and I'm doing something with his lyrics the way I did with the Johnny Cash lyrics. I've taken the verse and then writing something that will go with what they're already doing. You know what I mean? Rather than the musicians finding a way to improvise with what I've already done.
Right.
So those are two different ways of working with it.
Yeah. So, you know, you perform with musicians, you've written for the page. Do you think of yourself more as a poet, a writer, or a performer, or do you even think of yourself in those terms, or what do you consider the distinctions to be?
Well, I consider us making art,
yeah.
You know, and sometimes I get this, like, amazing opportunity to create this, like, sustainable art, like, at the moment, something that never happened again, never happened before, it's never going to happen again, you know, that's what we always say, whatever we're doing here, you're never going to see it again, because we could do the same piece 20 times, it's never going to be the same.
Right.
So that's just, you know, an amazing experience to get together with other people and create these pieces on the spot. Even if I have the words already, we're still creating these pieces on the spot. So, I mean, I just think of myself as an artist.
Yeah. You know, as was mentioned at the top of the show, you also helped produce a show called Bowery Electric Pandemonium, and I believe you have another one of those shows coming up in April. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, that's my show.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's one of those things that also, like, just synchronically came together. Like, you know, I used to produce these shows. I always enjoyed producing shows. I hadn't done it. And I had done some on my own as well. But this was, you know, when I was also already getting really into working with, you know, rock and roll and poetry. And so I'm thinking about it. And then the people who do Happy Hour, which is Mary Raphael behind the bar and Tim Greer as the DJ, they, I guess, had spoken to the manager, Barry Electric, Diane, and said, you know, we think it would be great if we had a show here during our happy hour. We're coming up on a six-month anniversary. Do you want to, like, produce something?
Nice.
So, you know. So I did that, and then and it was very successful. So I decided to do it quarterly, not monthly, but quarterly. So make it like really an event that people look forward to. And the Barry Electric is very supportive because they do a lot of promoting. They make flyers. They put it on their website. So we get a really, really good response.
Yeah. So in addition to playing out with musicians and maybe more sort of bar settings or whatever, do you still frequent poetry venues in New York?
Well, there aren't that many to frequent anymore.
Wow.
To tell you the truth.
Well, that was my question. What's left?
Well, Great Weather for Media, I think, has one of the best readings around, which I think you're going to be a guest there when you come in June, right?
Well, actually, it's been moved to September.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, I mean, in terms of you're doing a show for me, I always do one in September. Maybe maybe that'll match up. But anyway, you know, they have a reading every Sunday at the Parkside Lounge, which is a place I perform many, many times with bands, and at 4 o'clock on Sundays. And it's a very good reading, and it's a donation in the bucket. Like, there are a lot of people who are doing very well with people paying $10 to come in each time. I guess some people have $10 to go to a poetry reading with.
Sure.
You know, even for just an open mic. I mean, there's a lot of pay-to-play going on here, which is, you know, it's not something that I can really do, you know, but it's keeping, you know, but people can do it and it's keeping it alive, that's fine. You know, it's also in New York, you see a lot of polarization with age. Like, it used to be there was the slam scene.
Yeah.
There still is a slam scene. So if you're not into the slam scene, you're probably not going that much to those events.
Yeah.
Even though there is a great night, you know, Louder Arts, which you probably know them,
sure,
on Monday nights. So yeah, they get great poets. It's an exciting venue. When I go, I'm probably like one of the few older people there, but that's okay. They're great, you know, I don't feel like unwelcome or anything like that. I just don't really go that much. And I actually only go there to watch. I don't go there to perform.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. But they have some great features and I'll go there for that. And, you know, the same thing with the New Eureka. Like, it's become a very, very popular place. We did our alternative New Year's Day marathon there, which was a great event to have. But I'm not going to go there and get online and, you know, and pay like $10. Well, I'll go there occasionally for something that I really want to see. And it used to be you could really go to a lot of venues. And that's probably, you know, there's some in Brooklyn and the Bronx. Yes, they're still around. It's just that I'd rather do other things most of the time, frankly, is what it comes down to.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Great Weather for Media just before with their venue, and I know that you were on the road with them not that long ago, because that was when I met you out here in L.A. What was that tour like for you?
Oh, that was great, you know. We really had a good time. It was great seeing people and seeing other poets. I had a really nice time. I mean, and you learn from experience, like, you know, like Santa Fe is very tricky. I don't know if that would be a place they would go back to.
Yeah.
In terms of getting an audience of poetry.
Something like that.
Yeah. But I think the other readings like really went well. It was great finally getting to read it Beyond Baroque, and you know, every time, and by this time, you know, I'm really used to coming out to LA, so I was really happy I got to go to Dennis Cruz's book party.
Yep.
You know, at
Last Bookstore.
What's it called? Yeah, the Last Bookstore.
Yeah.
Because I had read there the year before, because I had done my own world tour the year before, and I'd been in LA.
Yeah. In fact, the Rare Bird offices where we record Poetescape, it's right next door to Last Bookstore. Great bookstore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. You know, I actually like the scene in L.A. a lot. It seems to me that it's more diverse.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was actually one thing I wanted to ask you, East Coast versus West Coast poetry.
I think, to me, it seems like the West Coast poetry is more exciting. The West Coast thing to me seems more exciting now. I don't know, when you're visiting someplace, you don't know. Maybe it would get tedious if I was there for a long time. I can't say.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a kind of fresher energy. And like I said, I think the diversity is really what makes it for me.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't seem as polarized as to age and race.
Yeah,
and I think that the West Coast has also kept that sensibility, that old punk rock, do-it-yourself kind of sensibility,
mm-hmm,
of kind of merging like the musicians in with the poets and creating those types of scenes.
Nice.
And keeping that going, you know.
Yeah. Why don't you go ahead and we're getting close to the end of our time. Why don't you read another poem for us?
Okay. I actually have the manuscript open for I'm going to read this one. It's a really old favorite of mine. It was written about an hour after I heard that Jim Carroll died.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, and speaking of the West Coast, S.A. Griffin, I did it on a radio show with him and the late Scott Weinberg right after I wrote it, and
yeah.
S.A. at his own expense published it as a broadside.
Nice.
Yeah, as a limited edition. So this is called The Best I Can Do Right Now. Today is a new day, I am told, filled with blessings, joy, and glory. Yes, my brothers, sunrise in our tired eyes and declare our redemption. Exaltation holds its sour breath as death bangs on tenement doors, rings broken bells and stalled elevators. We are not home. We are not home. Radiantly, we buy milk and smoke cigarettes. Why are we saved? Why are we saved? Because it's 2 hours later than it was 2 hours ago, when neither half moon nor aging fiery balls of faith knocked at dirty windows, smudged by memory, less than an illusion, more than facts. Because we lived. Because we lived through dream darkness. Because we lived through dream darkness, do we now greet the light as a miracle, forcing greater decisions upon us? If only. If only I could draw curtains on today, drop shades on bitter consciousness, play a deathbed song without remorse, bury bones of guilt so deep dogs will never dig them out, they will never dig them out, they'll just bark, bark, bark like saxophones, and cats will scratch at their necks and wonder why. They'll wonder why. Why do we need new days at all? The old ones aren't dead yet, and they all smell pretty much the same. And
nice, that was beautiful. And I love Jim Carroll too.
Yeah.
You know, by your own account, you've referred to yourself as a poster girl for reinvention, which I love, by the way. I was wondering if you could talk about that before we close out the show.
I guess that I don't know. I'll tell you what my son said. My kids, you know, came to my book party for knuckle tattoos, and he said, like, wow, like Joan Jett's on stage, and it's my mother, you know. You know, like you really, really can. You don't have to be stuck in whatever box you're in. You really can constantly recreate. And I don't mean like being a chameleon. You take whoever you are with you, and you add to that, and you experience new things, and that becomes part of your life. That life is cumulative.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just like you're not just one thing that you have to stay being. You know, and I think we can just keep on going in one way or another, even if the body gives out, you know, a bit, if the mind and spirit are willing, we can keep looking at things in different ways. I guess it's like the end of that poem, 20 years in a day, as long as we keep looking up, you know?
That's right. That's right. So what's the best way for people to find out about you online, to get your work or to find out about your shows?
Well, they can do one of two things. They can find me on Facebook, which is PUMAPERL, and we'll be putting up a lot of links to the show, I suppose, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that will be on Facebook, and they can also I have a blog, which and on the blog I don't like blog a lot, but I do have every video cataloged on there, and there's links to the Facebook page, to the publishing pages, you know, to everything else, and there will be a link to this radio show on there, and that's www.pumaperl.blogspot.com.
Cool.
Or if they, you know, they just, you know, Google Puma Pearl blog, that'll come right up.
Yeah. So with me today has been the New York City poet Puma Pearl. Puma, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Rich, and I guess I'll see you in September.
Yeah. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify, and Twitter. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com. YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth and Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be filmmaker Finn Taylor. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.